All right, you pick your favorite. European economic agita, the trade war with China not being on hold anymore, or manufacturing in America circa 2018. Nah, you don't have to choose. We're going to do them all. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 29th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This would be oh so much more effective if I knew how to say it in Italian, but you go on the air with the language you got, I guess. The theme of the broadcast today is swift and sudden change. It happened in television this morning. We'll get to Roseanne in a minute, but the macroeconomic lead story for us on this Tuesday comes with a very distinct Italian flavor. Political upset in Rome this past weekend has led to a global case of investors today saying, wait, what now? Andrew Walker is the economic correspondent for the BBC. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Kai.
Give us, would you, the thumbnail political sketch, the political backdrop to all of this that's happening today.
Well, Italy had elections earlier this year, which produced a majority in the parliament for two parties combined, both of them anti-establishment populist parties is the word that's often used. They have tried to put together a government. It included, as economy minister, a man, Paolo Savona, who has in the past advocated leaving the Eurozone and described it as a German cage. Now, his appointment was vetoed by President Mattarella, I think on the grounds that he felt that such dramatic steps should not be taken without an explicit public debate in the course of some sort of political campaign. And that hadn't really happened. It was not part of the election manifesto of those two parties to leave the Eurozone.
And so this weekend, the president effectively vetoed a coalition, installed an old IMF official, former IMF official, and the bond market now has said, whoa, hold everything.
Yes, indeed. And it's frankly not because of the identity of the caretaker Prime Minister, Carlo Cottarelli. Initially, actually, the markets responded rather favourably to the idea of him being in charge. But it dawned on them, I think, that Italy is going to have further elections quite soon. And that did raise in the minds of many investors, I think, renewed questions about just how secure Italy's membership of the Eurozone is.
A lot of people will think, oh, my goodness, Italian crisis, Europe crisis, Greek debt crisis, and are we doing this all over again? Are we?
So far, we are not there. One measure that's often used to judge the situation is the yield, the return, if you like, on 10-year government debt. And when the Eurozone crisis was at its worst, the kind of rule of thumb that a lot of people used for whether the problem situation was really serious and a bailout would be needed was a figure of 7%. For Italy, the figure currently is still only around 3%. So increased strains in the financial system without a doubt, but not like they were back in 2011, 2012.
Do you think the Eurozone and the European Union are stronger now in a stronger position to deal with it than they were during the Greek debt crisis?
In some respects, yes, I think they are. They've made significant progress in unifying the Eurozone's banking system, making it more resilient. The countries that were at the worst of the crisis have actually seen stronger economic performance. Really clear examples of that are Spain and Ireland, which have been registering very strong growth. But having said that, Italy is huge. Bear in mind, the biggest country to need a bailout so far was Spain. The Italian economy is a lot bigger than that. So if things really were to go seriously downhill in Italy, then I think the Eurozone would face some significant problems. But I emphasize, Kai, we are not there yet.
Right. The manifestation, just quickly before I let you go, the manifestation today in the markets, in the bond markets specifically, but also in equities here in the States, that's really uncertainty, not actual crisis.
Uncertainty, yes, and indeed uncertainty revolving around this specific question about whether Italy might go in a direction that financial markets think would be a very bad thing.
Andrew Walker, the economics correspondent for the BBC. Andrew, thank you for your time.
My pleasure, Kai.
Italy, by the way, third largest economy in the Eurozone, eighth largest, depending on how you're counting, in the whole world. So it does kind of matter. As I alluded to, agita was the watchword in stocks today. A lot of that money went into bonds in search of safe haven. We will have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. Were it not for a vaguely troubling feeling of economic deja vu all over again coming out of Europe today, our lead on this program would probably have been a television show getting canceled. Not, of course, just any show, but one predicted to finish number 3 in the rankings this season with the attendant profitability that would bring. That was until, of course, Roseanne Barr on Twitter compared an African-American woman, Valerie Jarrett, a key advisor to President Obama, to an ape. Within a matter of hours, Channing Dungey, the head of ABC Entertainment, tweeted this, quote, "Roseanne's Twitter statement is an abhorrent, repugnant, and inconsistent with our values, and we have decided to cancel her show." We have gotten Emily Heil on the phone to discuss all this. She co-writes the Reliable Sources column at The Washington Post. Emily, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
So were you surprised that ABC canceled Roseanne?
I wasn't surprised that they canceled it. I guess I was a little bit surprised they canceled it so quickly. A lot of times there's a bit of a drip, drip, drip. Mm. Maybe there's some equivocation. Maybe there's some waffling. Should we put her on leave? That sort of thing. But this was so swift and so definitive that I was a little bit taken aback.
It did seem quick. But then again, you could legitimately ask the question, what took them so long, right? Because Roseanne has been... controversial is a really, really polite way to say it on Twitter. Racist is another more bald way to say it. And yet they kept putting her on the air.
Absolutely. And her Twitter habits were well known. She was often, as you said, controversial on Twitter and spread false conspiracy theories. There was some wariness, I think, on the part of ABC executives and her co-stars. Even last week, Sarah Gilbert, who mm-hmm. Co-stars on the show, is an executive producer, said that Roseanne Barr's TV kids and her real life kids tried to keep her off Twitter, knowing that some of the things that she said could jeopardize the entire show.
There is a little bit of ABC getting hoisted on its own petard here, right? Because they were really clear when this show came back that part of the motivation was to get, as a result of the election of 2016, to get some of those voices on the air in prime time in situation comedy. And now they are having to cancel the program because of Roseanne's voice, if that makes any sense.
That does. And in many ways, they enjoyed the fruits of the controversy that the show created. Every week there were headlines. And now they're sort of seeing this blow up in a way that I don't think they could have necessarily mm-hmm. seen coming, but maybe they should have.
Yeah. ABC, it has to be said, does not own this show. It's owned by a production company. What do you suppose the odds are of another network that is not home to Mickey Mouse and Snow White, or some cable network that wants to be a bit edgier, putting her back on the air?
That is possible, but it would have to be someone who does not rely on advertisers the way ABC does. I think that was the one thing about this that made the cancellation inevitable. As soon as people were reacting so strongly on social media and calling for boycotts, that's when it was the writing was on the wall. Yeah. So if someone else wanted to come along and pick this up, it would have to be, perhaps network that had some sort of conservative affiliation. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I'm not sure that many other people affiliated with the show would continue to do so.
You mentioned Sarah Gilbert, who played Roseanne's daughter on the program. She now and a whole slew of other people are out of a job. I mean, lighting technicians and stage managers and all of those folks now are done because of this.
And that is the unfortunate flip side to this when you have someone who is the public face of your creative project. Roseanne Barr is the Roseanne behind Roseanne. When the public face of a very large project goes down, everyone else kind of goes down with her. And we've seen this happen with, say, Harvey Weinstein. Many people were out of jobs because of his controversy. And so you see people who have nothing to do with this, who have, completely opposite views, who face the consequences along with the principals.
Emily Heil, staff writer at The Washington Post. Emily, thanks a lot.
Happy to join you.
Even allowing for the sometimes scattershot way the Trump administration makes economic policy, the twists and turns in the trade relationship with Beijing recently have been head-snapping. First, there were the president's steel and aluminum tariffs, you might remember, then other U.S. tariffs on Chinese imports in response to intellectual property theft and forced technology transfer. Then the Chinese listed their own tariffs. Then the president said he wanted to save jobs at the Chinese electronics firm ZTE. And then Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said the trade war was on hold. and now it's apparently back on again. The White House said in a statement this morning that it's going to limit some Chinese investments in American technology companies. It's going to file complaints against China at the World Trade Organization, and those intellectual property theft tariffs are back on, which gets to the crux of the U.S.-China relationship in the long term, innovation ideas, and who's going to play fair in the global economy. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
There's a mean, snarky joke in China that R&D does not stand for research and development, but receive and duplicate. But the headache for foreign companies is not just knockoffs. In China, you can lose your ideas and your legal protections to them, says attorney Claire Reed, a former U.S. trade negotiator.
Chinese firms steal a brand's designs and logos and then go and actually get trademark protection in China against the real company. This happened with Jordan sneakers.
And to do business in China in certain sectors, you must surrender your secrets in return. Jennifer Hillman, former judge at the World Trade Organization, says that is how the China rules work.
By forcing the United States and other foreign investors to transfer over their higher-end technology in everything from semiconductors to developing a 5G network or certain biotech items.
This is about ideas, innovation, and the industries of tomorrow. And the Trump administration has at times pledged to punish Beijing. But here's how China justifies its actions, says Eurasia Group analyst Paul Triolo.
The Chinese view on this is that China has the right to improve its industrial base, and this is something that they're not going to easily give up on.
Which, he says, makes intellectual property one of the most intractable and critical issues between the world's two largest economies. One question is whether this administration puts it on the table and keeps it there. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
A lot of big banks were among the losers on Wall Street today. Upset in the global bond economy is never smooth sailing for financial stocks. But when the books for the second quarter are closed, today is probably going to turn out to be a banking bright spot. All that stock trading people were doing and the commissions that banks get from them. Speaking of trading, we are expecting that tomorrow the Federal Reserve is going to propose some changes, relaxations more properly, to the Volcker Rule. What is that rule and why does it matter? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is on that one.
The Volcker Rule says banks that are insured by the government can't run around using your money making bets to make a quick buck.
The idea being that banks that have that kind of public support ought not be engaged in excessive risk-taking.
Aaron Lockwood teaches at UC Irvine. Now, sometimes banks do need to buy and sell things for good reasons.
Being able to match buyers and sellers for financial products.
Like, if you're a supermarket, it's a lot easier to just have oranges on hand in case someone wants to buy them, as opposed to having to go hunt them down. Similarly, banks need to be able to have corporate bonds on hand so they can buy and sell them for their clients.
This has been one of the big challenges and also, I think, sources of opposition to the Volcker Rule, is distinguishing between legitimate financial activities and speculation.
There are exceptions in the rule for this kind of thing, but they require a lot of data reporting. And for every little trade, a bank has to basically make a case that it's okay. Guy Moskowski is with Autonomous Research.
So there's a tremendously extensive data capturing and management process that's been ongoing.
So a lot of banks just haven't bothered to keep a lot of corporate bonds on hand.
The main problem is that the amount of liquidity in things like corporate bonds have fallen dramatically.
Maureen O'Hara is a professor at Cornell University. She says you need somebody to be able to help people buy and sell corporate bonds, especially when economic times get bad. A modified Volcker Rule, she says, would most likely help with that. It would also make banks more money. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up.
These are big, giant rolls of denim. What you're seeing here, these are the last runouts.
Manufacturing in America, part one. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, you knew it was going to be the Wawas. The Dow off 505 at one point today. At the Bell, down 1.5%, 391 points, 24,361. The Nasdaq down 0.5%, 37 points, 73.96. S&P 500 off 1 1/10, 31 points, 26.89. Banks I talked about, J.P. Morgan off 0.2%. Bank of America down 3 9/10% today. Told you about ABC's cancellation of the Roseanne show. Shares of ABC's parent company Disney fell 2 4/10% today. That was not Roseanne, by the way. That was the slow box office for Solo this weekend. I liked it, actually. You're listening to Marketplace. We heard from John in Austin, Texas, not too long ago, who says he and his wife think Marketplace is the most informative and creative radio program in America, which is nice to hear. If you agree with John, please join him as a Marketplace investor by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to John and everybody who makes our work possible.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I took a trip a couple of weeks ago trying to get some insight into this question. What does manufacturing in this economy look like right now? Because it's not what it used to be, right? And that's not a crack on it either. It's just true. We make different things than we used to. And manufacturing is a smaller slice of the economy overall than it was a couple of decades ago. But we're still talking millions of jobs, 12.5 million of them, according to the Department of Labor. So the once and future state of what America makes and how matters. Over the next 3 days, then, three slices of American manufacturing, starting with this guy.
Good morning. Monty Galbraith.
Morning, Monty.
You must be Kai.
Rizdahl, nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Monty Galbraith owns and runs DNA Textile Group in Columbus, Georgia. We had him on the program about a year and a half ago as part of a series we did on NAFTA.
This was a textile town. There were thousands of looms and hundreds of thousands of spindles all up and down this area. Since NAFTA was put into place, just about everybody has gone out of business. That was in the textile business. There's just a very, very few of us remaining.
Back then, Monty's company, DNA Textile, was one of only three in this country still making denim fabric, and he was doing all he could to keep it afloat. We called him again not too long ago with NAFTA and trade policy and American manufacturing in the news, and we asked if we could come see him.
Kai, this is the beginning of the process.
Tell me about these machines. I mean, are these giant? Are they loom? They're not looms.
No,
right?
We'll show you. We'll show you looms in just
all right.
a second.
Well, I don't know. I'm not a.
Now, yeah. We don't buy cotton. We buy it from yarn vendors like the building next door to us.
Yeah.
They actually bring the cotton in and spin it into yarn.
Okay.
We call those. Those are yarns.
They look like giant
right
sewing bobbins, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. And we take the one end of each one of those and we wrap. What we're trying to do is
so those little ones go onto this big giant
exactly.
one.
Exactly.
All right.
Now what you're seeing, Kai, is this is the indigo dyeing range. As you can see, it's down.
Yeah.
This was just, not too long ago, wide open, running wide open.
Wow.
And now you can see it is shut down.
It's literally dark. You turn the lights off.
It's literally dark. We have turned the lights off down here.
Monty's not getting the prices he wants or the demand he needs to keep his denim line running. But what he's doing about it is part of a bigger story about what it means to be a manufacturer in the American economy right now. And what it means is change.
We are transitioning it from denim and apparel fabrics to technical specialty fabrics.
So these are just big, giant rolls of denim?
These are big, giant rolls of denim. What you're seeing here, these are the last runouts of fabric that we're keeping our commitments to our customers who we've been doing business with these guys for 20, 30 years. And we made the decision to get out of the business. We felt it was important to honor these agreements and obligations that we had with them, as well as to help them build a bridge to other vendors.
DNA Textiles started making denim back in 2002, selling to Levi's, then Wrangler, Gap, and Old Navy, and Abercrombie and Fitch. Monty Galbraith's last contract is with Polo, and all of those brands I just mentioned have started bringing in finished jeans from overseas, China, Bangladesh, Vietnam, and Egypt. Monty's been in the denim business since he was a teenager.
This is, I'm a classic, the old term lint head. I've had lint in my hair my whole life.
This is an actual factory, too. 275,000 square feet, huge machines all over the place, all in the service of getting denim and other textiles out the door.
Oh, there you go. That's a loom, right?
No, we're not there yet. You'll know.
I'm going to stop guessing.
You will know when we get to the weave room.
Well, so what is this thing, right? What is this?
These are sand frizing machines. This is actually a machine that we're getting ready to take offline, because when we go to this new process, these won't be used in the new process.
This is a giant piece of gear. Is this just now lost cost here for you?
We're selling this to a dealer, basically for pennies on a dollar that we bought it for, though.
It's got to kill you.
It's killing me, Kai. You just don't know.
You sound almost wistful, actually, about shutting down the denim.
That's putting it mildly. This is something that I've done personally all my working life. At one point, Kai, we had over 300 people in this plant. We are down to less than 100 today.
I was going to say, it feels a little empty, and the shelves are a little empty.
It really is. And wistful is I'm being polite, because I'm more pissed off than anything else. Because we had 300 folks here. The last round of layoffs just were completed probably about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And so these are really good people. Some of them are like family to me, that have done nothing but great things their whole life. And now, because of trade laws, they are out of work and they are looking for jobs and they are scared to death.
When NAFTA went into effect in 1994, there were almost 500,000 people working at textile mills in this country. They're making everything from sheets to socks and T-shirts and all of it. The Labor Department says that now, textiles employs just north of 100,000 people here, and that there are just 2 mills making denim in the United States.
And all that production you used to do of denim fabrics has gone where?
Primarily to Asia. A little bit to what's left in this hemisphere is in Mexico, but the vast majority of it went to Asia, and has been in Asia for several years now.
So when you see the whole NAFTA debate going on, is that a factor for you?
Yeah, that ship sailed a long time ago. Going back and trying to rebuild NAFTA into what it was before then, nobody is saying that. I'm certainly not saying that. But that years ago when Ross Perot, the giant sucking sound, whether you agreed with his delivery or not of that line, it was absolutely positively he nailed it right on the head. And it wasn't just textiles, it was other manufacturing jobs that just have been sucked out of this country. That's what pisses me off. It's not just what happened to this company. It's what's happened to manufacturing in the U.S. that has just literally been sucked out of this building, out of this country, excuse me.
Well, no, it's an interesting Freudian slip, right? Out of this building.
Yeah, and it literally out of this building. So let me walk you through here and show you.
In the early days, DNA Textile had 350 people working in this factory. Now, after the latest layoffs this past January, it's less than 100, as Monty tries to make the turn from being a full-blown denim manufacturer to something smaller, making technical, high-end fabrics, wall coverings, airplane and auto seat covers, and flame-retardant uniforms and clothing. Smaller is not necessarily cheaper, though. There was market research to do, new equipment to get, and a new workforce as well.
The old days of just walking in and going to work and running the machine over and over and over again, I think in almost every industry, that's probably a thing of the past.
He knows change is hard, Monty Galbraith says, but he's still angry that the jobs that are leaving are the ones people could support their families on in a solid middle-class life.
It's a cliche, but it's not the biggest and the strongest, but it's the most adaptable that survive. And I think we've already shown our ability to adapt just to stay as long as we did. We don't want to go back, nor are we pining to go back. We understand things change. But it still makes you upset that good people, when they lose their jobs. But there's no turning back. No, there's not any way have I ever said, can we go back to the old days? Because things do change. I just wish I'd looked a little forward and moved a little faster, a little earlier.
Right. Anyway, lead on.
I'm going to take you to the weave room.
All right. Is that where I'm finally going to see the looms?
That's where you're going to finally,
right, finally
see the looms.
Man.
He's got 110 of them. They were super loud, so loud it was basically white noise.
Holy cow.
But for Monty Galbraith, it's the sound of money. His change away from denim, he says, is going to cost him $7 million. He's $1 million into it now, and it's going to be years until he will know whether he's been able to navigate the changes the economy says he has got to make. So that is one slice of manufacturing in America mid-2018. Tomorrow, slice two, same city, Columbus, Georgia. Totally different kind of stuff being made. Think big giant buckets of red hot metal. Columbus, Georgia, I ought to say, has a long, long history with the textile industry. We tell some of that story and post some pictures from our swing through Monte Galbraith's factory at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, which the Code of Ethics of Business and Economic Journalists obliges me to preface by saying that if a commodity needs what I am about to tell you about, yeah, go ahead and take it as a warning. From the Daily Mail over in the UK, this item: a rehab facility in Scotland is offering treatment for Bitcoin addiction, more formally, cryptocurrency trading addictions. Their theory is that Bitcoin traders exhibit some of the same characteristics as gambling addicts, which is a real and bad thing, to be clear. But if Bitcoin does that to people, is it really a good idea to think of Bitcoin as the future of currency? And we are out of here. As far as the markets go today, suffice it to say, not good. Digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.